In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Storytelling is a powerful tool because it creates a unique bridge between the storyteller and the audience. In an effective story, you become someone else for a while, experiencing what they see, what they think, what they feel, and how and what they believe. In storytelling, this effect is often referred to as transport, where the story is so engaging that it transports you from your world into the story. Stories can help you understand. Think how many times you didn't quite get something until someone used an example to explain a difficult concept by relating it to something that you do understand, maybe tying a math or economics concept to a real-world example. And then suddenly, oh, okay, I get it now. Storytelling techniques help connect what's in someone else's mind to what's in yours. While there are many techniques that go into effective storytelling and many different types of stories, like so many different houses built of bricks or stone or wood in a neighborhood among a world of other neighborhoods, the building blocks of stories all have the same foundation: characters, plot, and setting. Characters who live in a defined setting, which includes not only where but when, who want something, but there are complications that stand in the way. My old editing boss used to say, "Plot is what does a character want, and why can't they have it?" And that's the real spirit of a story. If there aren't complications, if there aren't obstacles that the characters need to overcome, it's not really a story. Audiences love complications, and the more impossible the odds, the more "how are they going to get out of this now?" the more we keep glued to the story. Stories where the characters have no real complications are mightily boring. And a story that doesn't resonate, that doesn't grab you, well, it's just not effective, and pretty soon forgotten. Many researchers, myself included, believe our brains are hardwired for stories. And because we're so receptive of stories, that's why the entertainment industry as a whole is a dominant and powerful force. Films and movies especially so, because of their unique ability to transport the audience and let them experience other worlds and other lives in a way that no other medium does. When you read fiction, it's your own mind co-creating with the author what it is that you see and envision. Movies, however, do that for you, making you experience what someone else envisioned, which opens up your mind to let other ways of thinking and viewing the world take root. In the wrong hands, storytelling can actually be used to do damage, to undermine beliefs, to open up people to inappropriate or wrong ways of thinking. For example, storytelling is one way how socialism and communism and Marxism spreads effectively. Think how many times a socialist trots out some victim of some policy, or that they need some new policy. Sergeant Dan served in Iraq, but now his employer doesn't cover all of his health care, and he has huge medical bills. His family is in danger of losing their house. So we need a nationalized plan so everyone can have access and everything will be paid for. It's like that great quote from Rand Paul that I mentioned last week. Mao, Stalin, and Hitler didn't come to power promoting tyranny. They came to power promoting equality. Socialists don't tell you about the misery of socialism where it ends up. They tell you about how unfair life is, how someone else has things better than you, and things will only get better if you turn against them. Funny. Sounds a bit like what was being whispered in Eve's ear in the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? Well, it's Christmas time when we remember the Christmas story of Jesus' birth that set him off on his own story, the central story of a much larger biblical story of God trying to redeem his creation. But look at all the complications just in the Christmas story. An unwed mother to give birth to the Savior? Wait, what now? Well, that's kind of awkward. What if Joseph had said, "I don't think so"? And then there's Herod trying to kill the Christ child, believing the Magi meant the king of the Jews was to be an earthly king. Or think of all those prophecies that had to be fulfilled. This week, we're going to talk about stories and making them, and we'll do that with filmmaker Jim Huggins, who not only tells stories for a living, but hopes his own life story will eventually lead him to the Oregon governor's office. Jim, it's great to talk to you again. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you guys, too. It's great to be back with you.
Absolutely. You know, you had risen to the level of lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and we talked about that last time, but that you Left that for private business and high-tech companies. You got a master's in engineering along with a doctorate in engineering management. But remind our audience about what led you to the film industry itself.
Oh, that's a lot. I don't know if you got enough time for that on the air. That's a very long story. But initially, my wife did. It was kind of a secret plot between her and a couple of other people that I had no idea they were trying to get me to audition for a stage play. I don't sing and I don't dance, and I got cast as the lead role in The Sound of Music. Great musical. And what I came to realize is that stories have a way of just kind of coming right up to you, sitting down next to you, and getting inside of you and becoming a part of you. And from that standpoint, stories are a great way, obviously, to entertain. And our entertainment industry knows that. And they obviously tell stories that are intended to evoke a particular purpose and reaction from you. So I got involved in storytelling because from my standpoint, when I first began studying and being involved in entertainment, it was in East Texas, and I looked out at my audiences, and these folks needed some distractions. They needed some entertainment because it was tough working in the hot summer sun in the Texas fields and so forth. But as I've come to learn and realize, as I studied acting, as I studied directing for film, and then started my own film company and started telling these stories, stories have a much deeper meaning. They have the ability, as I said, to become a part of you. But they also have a means of influencing society. I remember I was auditioned one time for a stage play and was asked, you know, how badly do you really want to do this? And I said, well, storytelling is part of who we are.
Yes,
it's part of the nature of humans. And so I'm on a red carpet interview one time for Footprints, our first film. I was asked, this was in Hollywood, I was asked a simple question. Why do you think films, faith-based films, belong back here in Hollywood? The key word there in that question was back.
Yes.
Faith-based films used to come out of Hollywood. They not so much anymore. The simple answer was, and as I was drawing this in the air with my finger, it's a circle. It's like, well, first of all, you know, society is influenced by the stories that we tell, and the stories are a reflection of society. So it's a circular argument. Are you happy with the direction that society is going? And I could see it in the reporter's eyes. And I said, no, then you change the stories. Mm. Story narratives, as I said, they have a way of getting inside of you. They become a part of you. And based on the stories that you're listening to, that's going to help drive the direction you and the rest of society is going.
That's right.
So I got into acting, I got into storytelling and writing books and producing movies. In order to have a positive influence on society, to provide an alternative. I'm not out there to beat you over the head with a scripture or deliver a sermon in a box. I refuse to do that. But what I do want to do is provide stories that will make you think and say, oh, I'd like to know more.
Yeah. And that's a great way to approach storytelling for sure. All right, let's go and take a break there. Come back. We'll have more with Jim Huggins. He's a filmmaker, and we're talking about Christmas and stories. Stay with us. It's Christmas time, and we're talking about stories here on the iSpy Radio Show and how those are put together. We're talking today with Jim Huggins, who not only produces stories for a living, but he's also running for governor on the Republican side, and we'll be sure to talk about that a little bit later. So, Jim, many stories rely on archetypes, and one of the most common ones is the wise old man, the sorcerer, who either has the magical sword or other key to victory for the hero, the secret knowledge oftentimes, and they mentor the young hero. You see that clearly in the original Star Wars with Obi-Wan Kenobi. Moving into movies was a bit of a radical change from your previous careers. Did you have a mentor who helped you along the way, or was it all pretty much self-taught?
Well, along the way, I've had different mentors that have come in and out of my life as the need has arisen. One of the mentors that I have is a colleague and a friend that I have absolutely treasured his advice. A gentleman by the name of Rich Peluso, who is the executive vice president for Sony Pictures and the head of Affirm Film. He heads up their faith and family division out there. He has never ever hesitated to answer any question or pick up the phone when I call or anything like that when I've asked for guidance. I think that it is absolutely critical that no matter what endeavor you are going into in life, that you have a mentor that can help guide you. Otherwise, you're going to be like a ping pong on a ping pong table. You're going to be bouncing all over the place. But no, I've had some mentors come along, and Rich Peluso with Sony is one. Earl Benjamin, who is the CEO for C3 Entertainment, and is also the head of Valorous TV, which is a subscription service, SVOD, or subscription video on demand service. Also, good friend, good mentor.
Hmm. So who are some of the people that you mentor?
Every time I work on a picture, whether it's a cast member or several cast members or any of the crew, keeping in mind on an independent film, the people that you interact with come and go. They typically don't stick around from one film to the next because there's a lot of time involved.
Yep, yep.
And in the independent film world, there's not a lot of pay. So they actually usually have day jobs and things like that. But there's typically a handful all across the board in the production spectrum where I'm working with and mentoring and trying to teach them the business side of storytelling. Storytelling has two different pieces. It has the creative part. That's where I'm the director of the film and I'm trying to impart the vision of the story. But then you have the production side. That's the part that most people in this industry don't know very well. And that's the business part. It's kind of like if you make a movie and nobody ever sees it, did you really make a movie?
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing we call, what do you call a movie that never gets distribution? A home video.
Yeah, and that's why so many people in front of the camera, all of those lefties, act like, well, gosh, money just magically appears. Isn't that funny how that works?
And obviously, yeah, it is funny. And what you may not realize is it actually does for their films a lot of times because there are other messages within the film beyond just the classic or typical hero's journey, as you were alluding to. The hero's journey is a 12-point journey that you take your character through. That is a fairly classic, time-proven method for telling a story and keeping people involved and getting a message across. That 12 steps that the hero goes through from being beaten down and coming up and beaten down again by his adversary and then ultimately prevailing in the end, it doesn't always have to be prevailing for good.
Mm-mm. No. No, that's very true. Well, as far as putting together your film company, what was the biggest challenge or obstacle for you to launch this venture? And how did you get past those? Maybe what didn't you expect along the way?
Oh, boy. I think the biggest challenge, and this just not just from a company perspective, but it's for every single film, has always been finding the funding to actually tell the story, to actually create the work of art, if you will. You have to pay the cast, if at all possible. Our first film, we weren't able to pay anybody. Everybody got behind the story because the story itself was something that people believed in, and it attracted a significant amount of both talent in front of and behind the camera. So we were very, very fortunate, very blessed in that regard. Money's usually the biggest issue, though, because if you're not paying your cast, you've got to buy equipment or you at least have to rent it. And let's not forget, the most important thing you have to do is feed everybody. So think about it. If you're on production, if you're doing a production and you're on set for, you know, a month or two, you have at least three meals a day. You have snacks and all sorts of things like that. You generally for 6 days a week. That's not cheap. And again, and with our first film, the community actually came together and donated our food. When they found out what we were doing and what the story we were trying to tell, the community got behind it. So ultimately, why the film was a six-figure cost. We didn't raise six figures to be able to produce it, but the people in and around us came together to do that. It was truly a grassroots effort.
Yeah, an army moves on its stomachs, but films get made on the craft services, that's for sure.
Yeah, amen. That's exactly right. You got it.
Yeah, well, I was going to save this for later, but since you bring up money, as you say, you just simply cannot do this without any money at all. It used to be that Hollywood would label films low budget for anything under $1 million, but now they bump that up to anything under $2 million. They're just simply not cheap to put together. So where did the funding eventually start coming from you to launch, either launch your film company or just get these films made? Are you talking self-funded? Was it you maybe brought on a venture partner or maybe even crowdfunding?
Yeah, we have on our first film, there was my wife worked three jobs to help pay the bills and raise up some money because I was just so dedicated in trying to pull the resources and the people together.
Well, that was, her fault because she got you involved in it.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So she's been a silent partner, but she's been huge in helping us at least be able to pay the bills and make the basics happen. We've had we've held various fundraisers. Some of them have been crowdfunding, such as on our last film, The 211 Home. We've had silent donors come up. People just not necessarily anonymous. We know who they are, but they've refused any credit. They don't want anybody to know that they've been involved. But you know, they've written some very nice checks that have helped keep us going.
That's awesome. Well, and it, I think that really speaks to people are really hungry for this kind of film, and they recognize, as you said, and as I said, the power of stories and how important this can be and how influential it can be in society today and how needed it is for sure. Okay, let's go and take a break. We'll be back with more with Jim Huggins. And welcome back. You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Jim Huggins. He is a lieutenant colonel. He's a doctor, and he's an ordained minister, and he's also running for governor here in Oregon. And we're talking about stories and how they're put together, seeing how he runs a film company. And Jim, just to talk a little bit more about the funding aspect, you had mentioned during the break that you guys just don't get involved in venture capital at all. And I totally agree with your thoughts on that. Why don't you share that with our audience?
Yeah, when you work with venture capitalists, they're buying into the project. Some of them are buying into the company, for that matter, but they're typically buying into that particular movie or that particular project. Once they bring the money in, they also begin to want to exert control over the story. And it's not uncommon for large investors or even significant investors to come in with money and start demanding changes to the story, the storyline, how it's being told. You know, that the director and or the writer may have. That's usually the kiss of death for a project, at least if you want to maintain your artistic integrity with that, and that's just something that we don't do. It's kind of like in a political world where you're accepting money from big PACs. Mm-hmm. The PACs start controlling the political environment. That's just not good business. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, we've certainly seen that with a lot of candidates here in Oregon. A few years ago, one of them was running for a statewide position, brought in some huge capital funders, and suddenly they changed the entire tenor of her campaign. So, just unfortunate. And you also see that in business, where you suddenly go public, and all of a sudden the shareholders start wanting things. They start electing people to the board that you would never have selected on your own, and suddenly the whole tenor of the business changes as well. So it's funny.
Yeah, exactly. You lose control of your vision. You have a vision. Mm-hmm. You have a reason you're doing this, and you're putting yourself into it. And you bring in a lot of outside money that's not involved with it at all, doesn't have any ownership or true stock in it. At that point, guess what? You've just lost your vision. You've lost control of what you're trying to do.
That's exactly right. So I can kind of hear people out there wondering just how expensive some of these films are. So give us a range of the films that you've made in terms of their production costs.
Yeah, all of them from a budget standpoint have been $150,000 at a minimum to the 211 Home was our latest one. That was actually budgeted at about $400,000. The reality is that you're almost never going to raise that money. So what you start doing is trying to figure out what can you actually get for deferred compensation, deferred services, because you know that you're going to have distribution and you're going to use your distribution revenue, i.e. the money in the future, to pay what you owe now. We don't start a project without distribution. Footprints was the first one, and that one was a very different distribution model. We're new, but nobody knew who we were. We needed to get that one into the market and be successful with it. that had a totally different business model of how to get that out there. But once we had that, and once we had the success with that particular film, then other movies were a little bit easier to do because we could get distribution up front. Once you have committed distribution, people will come along because they know they're eventually going to get paid. It's just a matter of when they're going to get it. So you can have a six-figure budget and only have five figures raised in actually being able to produce it as long as you have that distribution model at the end.
Right. Yeah, it's funny, you're talking there, and I flash on that line from It's a Wonderful Life, and George Bailey is saying, I don't know if I can do this. You spend your whole life trying to figure out how to save 2 cents on a length of pipe.
That's kind of
filmmaking right there, isn't it? So
filmmaking used to be from the standpoint, if you got three titles out and you did real well with three titles within about 10 years, you know, you did a title every 3 years, not only were you considered a success, all of a sudden people started not throwing money at you, but money became very easily accessible. Today, not so much the case. It's usually about five or six films that you have to be able to get out in a relatively short period of time because the technology has changed so much of the film industry in the past 15 years. It's no longer true film-based and a stovepipe system. This is truly integrated. You can make a movie on a laptop. It's certainly not going to be at the quality level of you know, one of the major houses, but you can start getting some small short films out. We also have a huge market space out there for film festivals to be able to get your works seen and get it noticed. You start doing that, you'll start getting distribution offers if you start winning some festivals.
Yeah. Now, you have won some awards, haven't you?
Yes. We've won quite a few, to be honest with you. Forgotten Heroes, the Robert Hartsock story, our second film out, has earned over 65 different awards around the world for the story, for the directing, the production, pretty much every aspect of that particular film. I'm really honored to have been able to tell that story. That was a humbling experience to be able to tell the story of the only military working dog handler to have ever received the Medal of Honor in Vietnam. It's just a phenomenal story. Mm. The 211 Home, our latest release, it's out in festivals now. We've also picked up, we've already started with our distribution. We're going to be on PureFlix Entertainment. We're already on Valorous TV right now. But we have had, I'm losing count. We've got at least 15 awards up front before we ever produced the film. We had awards for the artwork, for the poster. We had awards for the script. Screenwriting awards were very, very important to demonstrate that this particular story had a lot of ability to get legs out in the market space. We've already won Best Film, Best Director, Best Producer. We've had several of our cast win Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Actress awards. It's doing quite well for us also.
Having spent a couple of years in the film industry, I can tell you 65 awards for a single film, especially it being, I think you said, the second film that you guys did, that is extremely impressive. That is extremely impressive.
That one, to be honest with you, we knew we had something, but that blew me away. I would never have imagined that that would have been that successful. We knew we had a good story. We knew we told it well, but that story just resonated with people. And we don't ever tell anybody the ending of any of our stories, but particularly that one. It's the last 30 seconds of that film that's going to get you. And that's really been a huge, huge win for us.
That's really cool. Okay, let's take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Jim Huggins. He is the CEO, producer, and director for New Shepherd Films. You can find the links to that on this week's show page at iSpyRadio.com. Stay with us. More about putting together stories coming up. And welcome back. It's Christmas time, and we're talking about stories today, putting them together, and we're doing that with Dr. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Huggins, who is president and CEO of a successful film company based in Salem. It's New Shepherd Films. And Jim, why don't you go ahead and give us your website and how people can find out more about your films?
Sure. The easiest way to do it is just go to newshepherdfilms.com. That's newshepherdfilms.com. Our films are listed on there. We try to keep the website up to date as best we can, but sometimes it's a bit of a challenge because there's so much information that happens on a frequent basis that it's difficult to keep that updated. Sure. But it's all out there. You can learn about all of the films, and you can certainly click on links to go get copies of them. You can learn about the books that we've got as well, because not everybody wants to watch a story. Some people like to read about them, so we do them. We do them in book form as well. You can find us on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com and just look up New Shepherd Films. And of course, each of our titles have their own fan pages as well.
So let's go ahead and talk about your current company. And this is from your website. Quote: Founded in 2009, New Shepherd Films has quickly become a recognized leader in Christian entertainment. In each film, we strive to tell true stories that are uplifting and inspiring, yet told in a way that appeals to the broadest audience possible and captures the imaginations of all people, regardless of age or faith. So which came first, really, the idea for the films or the idea for the company?
The idea for the films. The company enables the films. And as I was mentioning during the break, I actually started as a director. I started as an actor first on stage, but then moved to the director position behind the camera when I started doing some TV and other work. That's the point where I'm going, okay, I can make movies. I know how to do this. I know how to tell the stories, but I don't have a means to actually produce the product. I know what the product is, but I can't get it out. And that's why we formed a film company, so that we could have the ability to actually treat this as a business.
Hmm. So since you are running for governor, I thought it might help people to get a better idea about you and how you might run the state by hearing about your management philosophy and on how you choose and put together staff. And just so people know, there are a lot of people involved when it's time to put a film together. It's not just the actors and the director, but the writer, the crew, especially sound and light. You got wardrobe, yep, and makeup, and that's just getting it shot. And then after it's been shot, you've got everyone else. You've got music scores, you've got film and audio editors, you've got special effects perhaps, or CGI, and then of course marketing and distribution. So what's your management philosophy on how and who you choose to surround yourself with?
Well, you know, you sound like you've got an awful lot of experience in the film industry. You're absolutely right. Footprints, by the way, our very first film during production had over 500 people involved, cast and crew. Most of that was cast. The 211 Home was supposed to have a little over 1,000, but COVID obviously required us to scale back an awful lot of the story and bring it in tighter so that we could do it with a smaller number of people. My philosophy is very simple, or at least I think it's pretty simple. Number one, you find the best people for the job. You find people that are the best qualified for a given set of tasks or job that you have, and you get out of their way. You enable them to do their job to the very best of their ability. You highlight where what the goal is, what the target is that you're trying to do, and what it needs to look like when you get done, and you get out of the way. It's a team-oriented approach. I expect a high degree of communication between the team members, particularly with the team leaders around me, and I trust the team leaders to run their teams. I'm not going to step in and tell, you know, the lighting crew how and where to set lights unless, as the director, when everything is set up, I'm going, that light doesn't motivate the scene the way I wanted, and this is my opportunity to begin teaching and saying, okay, here's how the light needs to work. I should have done a better job explaining it, but the bottom line is, this is what we need. So there's a lot of communication. I'm probably very big in over-communicating. I'd rather somebody say, yeah, I know, you already told me that, or yeah, I already know that, than to go, oh, well, that's new. I wish I'd known that sooner. You know, that's really the last thing you want to hear. And that works whether you're in the military or whether you're making films. It doesn't really matter. The whole notion of being able to clearly identify a target, recognize what you want things to look like when you're done, and what we call that in the military is, you know, I want to know what the battlefield looks like as I'm walking off.
So it's very different when you're starting your own film company or doing your own production work, and you're the one choosing all the staff. In government, should you get to the governor's office, there's a lot of people already there. Some of these agencies, they've got their staff. How do you see yourself working with people there that may, you know, like what Trump ran into, they were willing to sabotage him every step of the way.
Yeah. Well, again, though, you have to look at it from the standpoint of what's the objective? What is the government supposed to be doing? And in the case of the governor's office, who and what is the governor? The governor is the top law enforcement executive in the government, period. And everything should be focused on holding people accountable and following the law. And if you're not on board with that, then you have to leave. It's that simple. And we find people that are. So whether or not there's a large turnover of staff or whether the staff is educated to realize, wait a minute, that's not how you should be doing your job. You need to be doing it this way. Regardless, things have to change. And they will change because the path that we're on now, the manner in which we're traveling that path, both of those have to change and change drastically. They need to come back closer to, if not closer to, but in line with our state constitution as well as our federal constitution. We need to follow the law, and we need to understand what the rights are of our citizens and what that freedom means, and not be trying to force a narrative, go back to storytelling, force a narrative on people that is simply not true.
Yeah. Okay, next question is a little bit of a big one, so let's go ahead and take a break now. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Jim Huggins, CEO of New Shepherd Films, talking about stories. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Jim Huggins, who not only produces stories for a living, but he's also running for governor on the Republican side. And Jim, we've been in that last segment there, we were talking about if you do get into the governor's office, what that's going to be like working with staff that's already there and very established. And looking back at Trump's presidency, I really think that was kind of a key mistake of his, is that he really thought that when he got into the presidency, people would just naturally come around. And of course, they'd want to support America. Of course, they'd want to make the next president successful. And instead, what we saw was them willing to sabotage him from top to bottom. And you know, looking at what's going on in Oregon, I think there's a lot of room for people to maybe move to a new job there, not just within the state.
Yes.
Maybe you ought to look at going into the private industry and understanding the private industry a little bit better, and then coming back to the government side of things with a greater understanding of how things actually work. So in terms of applying your management philosophy and skills to the state, what are some of the reforms staffing-wise that really ought to be put into place, especially when you do run into people that just are so resistant, they're not going to help you no matter what you try to do?
Right. Well, generally, one of the very big words that I like to use is called accountability. You are accountable for doing your job and doing your job well, doing it with excellence. Your accountability means that your job performance is transparent. We're the government. We work for the people. The people that are out there voting and trying to live their lives with their businesses, they're the ones that run the state. They run it through their work, with their taxes, and with their votes. And the government is there to serve them. And I really believe, for the most part, we have that very backwards, or at least our government has it very backwards.
Yeah. We'll
and if we don't listen to folks, we're really going to have a very discontented population, and that's what we've got now. So from my standpoint, accountability is number one. You're accountable for how you do your job, and you are to do your job with excellence, and it has to be done transparently. If you can't do that, then you really do need to go find another job. The other thing, too, is that you have to understand what your job is. And I question in some cases whether or not folks truly understand what their job is because they've listened to a narrative that's been preached from a very small minority of people, but they are the folks that are in charge saying, this is what we have to do. You have to live your life this way. No, that's kind of backwards. We don't have to live our life the way that our government tells us. We have our rights and we have our freedoms. That is how we live. And you, the government, are there to support and defend those.
Yep, that's absolutely right. And the other thing that I hope that you would bring to the office is, and this really taps into your experience producing films, where you've got to run things, you've got to put out a quality product, but at the same time, you're always looking at the bottom line. And that is something completely lost when it comes to government.
Yeah.
There is no sense of efficiency because there's just always more money.
And the fallacy with that is there's not always more money. There will come a point where you run out of the other person's money that you're spending, and that other person's money is the taxpayer. If you take money from the taxpayer, then you're taking money out of the economy. You're taking money out of the growth of the state or the nation, depending on whether we're talking state or federal. But you're taking that money away from the opportunities that we need to be creating in the state. When you then take it and keep it for the state and then spend it however you desire, without a notion of that bottom line, not only is that reckless and irresponsible, but it's very, very short-sighted. It may get you by for a year or two or a couple of budget cycles, but ultimately you're going to have to pay the price. PERS is a perfect example of a scenario where people created a system without the foggiest notion of what business actually was like and what the bottom line needs to, or how the bottom line needs to be managed. Under no circumstances should we be, robbing Peter to pay Paul, as the saying goes. In this case, we need to be trying to determine how can we make the state flourish. And you cannot do that under taxation, and you cannot do that constantly spending other people's money. It just doesn't work.
No, absolutely not. Although nowadays in government, we're borrowing money from Paul to pay Peter, who already has a loan with us, and so now we're at
it's a
cycle. So, in terms of your staffing, getting back to that, your website says your co-founder is Russell Dougherty. Talk to us about him, but also some of your other key members of your staff and what roles do they play. Do you have full-time staff, or is it all basically contract players that come in once a film gets going?
It's pretty much contract from the standpoint of development of a story can be done by one or two people or three people bouncing ideas off of each other. But once you start ramping up, you're needing equipment, you're needing people, you're needing resources, locations, all of that. Then you start adding on people as the system demands. You don't keep them on board the whole time. Nobody's a full-time person except for, well, I guess me, but I don't really draw a salary. But the Russ came to us, back in 2009 as an editor, as a cinematographer. He's the guy with the vision behind the camera to actually begin crafting the product with the guidance of the director. Russ came to us with about 25 years of experience, maybe 30 actually, of video work, cinematography, that sort of thing. I brought the business side of it to the table, as well as being able to direct. So between the two of us, you actually had a pretty well-rounded individual set of skills. Of course, my wife, Leslie, is one of our associate producers. She works behind the scenes to help us with logistics and with funding. On the recent project out here with Forgotten Heroes, a gentleman here in the Salem area, Jeff Snyder, started working with me on doing some of the CGI work and some of the story development, and took over in the role of cinematography. And then with the 211 Home, he is the DP for this film, as well as one of the co-producers. Another gentleman that joined with us here in the Salem area, a gentleman by the name of Abel Martinez. Abel has a number of films to his credit, and has worked with Jeff before. And so Abel brings to the table a larger perspective or a larger capability for New Shepherd Films, because what he's able to do is wrangle the staff and wrangle the cast, so that when we're on set, neither Jeff nor I have to worry about, did so-and-so get lunch, or did so-and-so show up where they need to? Do they have their lines? Are they ready to go? There's so many details that you have to be tracking, that everybody has a role. So as we've picked up and moved forward, we've actually increased our key staff to be able to manage these larger projects.
Yeah, and it can quickly get really out of control in putting together some of these. I mean, there are just so many details constantly wrangling with. So, okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll wrap things up with Jim Huggins. We'll take one last peek behind the camera. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're on our final segment now. Jim Huggins, he is running for governor, but he's also has a successful film company here in the Salem area, New Shepherd Films, if you want to check them out. And we'll put a link up to that on iSpyRadio.com. And Jim, I thought we'd shift a little bit into the actual creation of these films. And I was mentioning during the break there that I've worked on a couple films, one of which it was for somebody that I had met on another film, and she decided to produce her own. And oh my gosh, everybody above the line, all of the actresses and the directors and stuff, flaming liberals, nice people, but flaming liberals on their politics. And it just happened to be when Hillary was running for president there, versus Obama. And oh my gosh, some of the discussions they'd get into. But everybody behind the camera and on the production side, very strong conservatives in many ways.
Yeah, that's not an unusual scenario, because a lot of the conservatives are having to move in the circles where they are really very focused on the budget, very focused on the money. It's not a fun place to be, because you have to be able to demonstrate you're going to be able to get your investors their money back and that sort of thing. In an environment where, you know, from an artistic standpoint, the money's generally, it's going to be there one way or the other, and that frees you to think about, you know, the art and the element of being able to tell the story or create it or what have you. Now, it's kind of dangerous to draw it like that, because it's not really, that stereotypical between liberal and conservatism, but there are some significant parallels there that we see, you know, within our own governmental systems.
Yep.
One of the things that you'll find is that the smaller side of the equation are going to be the folks managing the business and running it, which is, in my opinion, where government needs to go, is to be a smaller entity, not a larger entity, so that the people who can truly think outside the box, which are typically small business owners because they have to think outside the box, they're the ones that drive the state, and we need to let them go. The government does need to draw down, I think, in terms of its size and capabilities, in terms of supporting and enabling people. That's where we need to focus. But let's not forget, we do have an area that's being drawn down that we shouldn't be drawing down. If anything, we should be building it up. It's called defunding the police. Part of the government is also to ensure the domestic tranquility. That means the peace, keeping the peace, enforcing the laws, and being able to hold people accountable and keeping the peace. We shouldn't be defunding the police. We need to have a strong capability to protect and defend our citizens.
Yes.
And not abrogate that responsibility. There's a lot of parallels here from the business environment that I work in, where we tell stories and we listen in politics. Politicians tell stories too. The problem is they've already got the bully pulpit, and it's very difficult for them to tell the full story, or even maybe a true story for that matter. But all stories have a common theme to them. They have an audience, they have a purpose, and they have a reaction. They have a defined audience of who they're talking to, a purpose of why they're talking to them, and a reaction of what they want you to do when you finish listening. From my standpoint, that audience, purpose, and reaction, I want the voters to know who I am. I want them to know what their government is doing and why, and I want them to go vote accordingly once they've become truly informed.
Do you think a lot of voters really understand the real problems facing government?
I think a lot of voters intuitively have a feeling, but I don't think they know it for sure, because every time I go out and talk to groups, and I will throw out facts and support those facts with hard data, I have people staring at me like, are you serious? I had no idea. I think people feel it, but they don't know it. And that's a very, very big difference.
Yeah.
I think once the voters understand and truly know what's going on, they're going to make a change.
Yeah, they just feel that something is wrong with government. We certainly saw that happening out in Virginia. And suddenly they learned why things were so wrong there with government. Anyway, in terms of just to wrap things up here, we've got about 3 minutes with you. And I'd like to talk about the process of how you put together these films. So it all really starts with the script, or the idea anyway, for the film. How do you find those scripts, and how do you say, this is the one that I want?
Well, I hate to say this, but I find ones I like.
Well, you should.
I mean, think about it. Think about it. If I'm the one that's going to be ultimately, funding this or trying to sell this, I've really got to believe in it. I'm not going to get involved in a project that I don't personally believe in. It's just like I'm not going to run for governor if I don't personally believe that I can make the difference that's needed for the state. I'm not going to make a film that I don't think is going to be enjoyed. I'm going to make one because it has a purpose to tell that story. There's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, I mean, that just is really reflective of government, too, is that when you decide to make a film, you got to say, do I really want to spend money on this? And I think that's true of government. Is this program really necessary that we're willing to spend millions of dollars on that? And are we really getting that kind of value from it? In terms of...
Let me interrupt you just a moment, if I may. It's not just do I want to spend money on it, particularly on a film. Do I want to dedicate the next 3 years of my life and drag my family through this process of making a film, which is extremely difficult to do, in order to tell this story? And it's the very same thing with the government side of this equation. Do I want to take my family through what we're about to go through in order to become governor?
Right, right. Yeah, that's the important questions there. In terms of once you settle on that screenplay and mm-hmm. you say, okay, this is the story I really want to do, the other big aspect of that is finding the right actors to fill those roles. Talk to us about that. How you select those actors, what goes into your mindset in order to get that the person that best embodies how you envision that role to be?
Right. And I'll be honest with you right up front. That's probably the hardest part of the whole process, because just because you find one actor, you're actually trying to put together an ensemble that has to work well to create the total picture, not just the one person. And that's what I look for, is I look for a team that can tell the story, not just one or two actors or actresses that have name recognition. What I look for is somebody that, first of all, I've seen their performance. I know what they're capable of. Can they bring the emotion to the character? If yes, I approach them, give them a one sheet, possibly send them a script and so forth. And I have to let them get sold on the story. If they can't get behind the story, if they can't get enthused by it, there's nothing I can or should do to force that. Yeah. Same thing with any aspect of any work I've ever done. If the person that I'm interviewing can't get involved and excited about it, I don't want them on the team. They're not going to perform. I don't want a performance. I want it to be realistic, and that's the fundamental difference.
And what a great approach for government too. If you can't get behind it, if you don't want to see this succeed, then maybe it's time you find another job. Jim, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today, and we hope that you have a great Christmas.
Thank you. I hope you guys have a great Christmas as well. And, you know, as always, great talking to you guys. Yeah, I love your format, love your show. Don't hesitate to give me a holler if there's any questions you've got, or I can do anything for you guys.
All right, will do. All of Jim's films, including his latest, The 211 House, which is a Christmas film, are available through ValorousTV.com. That's ValorousTV.com. Or go to NewShepherdFilms.com to get the DVD versions. And we'll have those linked on this week's show page on iSpyRadio.com as well. It is the Christmas season, and we certainly hope that you know the reason for the season. On behalf of my producer, Carla Davenport, and from me, a very Merry Christmas to you all, and a happy and prosperous New Year to you as well. 2022 holds great promise, but to make it great, I hope you'll get out there and find something you can do to make it a success, to retake what's been taken, to make your schools great, your city great, to make Oregon and America great once again. We need to work together to make it that way. It won't happen on its own. Because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.